So first, I would like to thank Jean-Jacques Hublin for inviting me. And today I'm going to talk the reproductive energetics in primates. Life history theory provides an evolutionary economics framework to generate and also test prediction about energy use about the life course, over the life course, sorry. The fundamental principle is that resources are limited and also depletable, such that each allocation to one function comes at the cost of other function. So as you can see on this figure, and you have seen this figure many times now, organisms face a major trade-off. They may invest heavily in current reproductive efforts, favoring higher reproductive success on the left side of this graph, or they could invest in somatic capital via growth or maintenance processes in order to ensure or enhance the future reproductive potential. So in this figure, you have also hormones and other biomarkers that are used as tools in primate studies for assessing this trade-off because they are mediators or product of these trade-offs. Primatologists largely consider energy in their investigation of primate behavior and life history. However, energetics comprises several dimensions that vary in their relevance for particular questions. The first dimension is how energy in the environment can be accessed by animals. So this will include food availability, food distribution, and also diet quality. The food availability is the spatial and temporal abundance of food. The food distribution will refer to how food items are spread across the habitat. And the food quality refers to the accessibility of nutrients, in particular food items. All of these variables will influence the potential energy intake of animals within a habitat. Energy intake will be the calorie that can be absorbed from the food consumed, and energy expenditure will refer to the use of calories for the body. Finally, the last dimension of energetics considers the energetic condition of the animal. So energy balance is the net difference between the intake and the expenditure, and energy status will be the quantity of stored energy, particularly fat. In primatology, we use a range of methods to quantify these various dimensions of energetics, from broad measure of the energy available in the environment, for example, we use phenology, and to specific assessment of energy dynamics on individual animals, and we use, for example, behavior or physiology. If we now look at the sex differences, we know that female mammals and female primates bear the energetic cost of gestation and also lactation. Therefore, it is often assumed that the overall energetic costs are greater for females than for males. However, the energetic cost to males of intrasexual competition may be also very high, which means that particularly if males have to maintain a much larger body size than females. Using data in about 20 species of non-human primate species, Key and Ross showed that the major determinant of sex difference in energetic cost is body size dimorphism. And in the long term, the energetic costs are often greater for females. But as you can see on this figure, when male body size exceeds female body size by 60% or more, male energetic costs are greater than for females. So, in highly sexually dimorphic species, the energetic cost of gestation and lactation are matched by the energetic cost to the males of maintaining a large body size. So the results presented here underline the importance of examining mammalian energetics from the perspective of both sexes. It's not that I have something against males, but today, since I have only 20-minute talks, I will only focus on the energetics of females. So gestation, we know that gestation and lactation are energy expensive. Primate infants are some of the most expensive, And the costs to primate mother are higher than for many other species, due mainly to the long lactation, to the high cost of caring, and to the extended periods of development associated with brain size. The key question that I will try to answer today is, how costly is lactation? How costly is primate infant growth? What are the trade-offs between the time and energy? And finally, how do female primates could minimize this cost? So here in this figure, you have the comparative lactation strategies among mammals, and the question is, are primates expensive? So you have different mammals. On the y-axis is the growth rate to weaning for infants. So this axis represents the energy cost, which means that if you are on the upper part, it's energy expensive, and the lower part, it's energy cheap. On the x-axis is the relative duration of lactational investment, so it represents the time cost. So on the right side, it's time expensive, and on the other side, it's time cheap. So on average, you can see that all the non-human primates are on the lower part, which means that they are energy cheap. But the time costs are highly variable and depend on the species, ranging from time cheap to time expensive. So is primate lactation cheap by comparison to other mammals? We know that milk is dilute and also low in energy and fat, as you can see on these figures for different great apes and in humans also. But milk is, however, delivered constantly. Then, as we suggested before, even if the energetic cost could be moderate, the time cost could be quite high and also variable between species and also between individuals. So to illustrate this, here are the results of a study that we conducted on 23 captive female olive baboons in a CNRS research station in the south of France. And the aim of this project was to explore the impact of energetics, of social rank, and also infant growth profiles on maternal reproduction. So on this figure, you have infant mass on the Y and the duration of postpartum amenorrhea on the X. The amenorrhea is the duration between birth and the resumption of cycling for females. And so the similarity between infant mass, irrespective of sex and maternal characteristic at the end of postpartum amenorrhea, suggested that infants either needed to attain a threshold mass or some ratio of maternal mass. And for both sexes, we showed that mothers resumed cycling when their infants weighed about 2 kilograms, as you can see with the blue line. Also, the time taken to attain this threshold was quite variable, varying from 50 days to 270 days. So in conclusion, infant mass at weaning seems constrained, but the time to resume cycling is variable. Another example, it's still in baboons. You have the duration of amenorrhea and the infant mass at 11 to 12 weeks. And we showed that females with light in blue here and potentially slowly growing infants took significantly longer to resume cycling than did females with heavy and rapidly growing infants. On this figure, you have the relationship between the ratio of infant to maternal mass after resumption of cycling and the interbirth interval for mother or different social ranks. What we've shown is that there was no relationship between this ratio of infant to maternal mass and the interbirth interval for low-ranking female in blue, but we show a very strong positive relationship for high and mid-ranking mothers with longer interbirth interval when the ratio infant to maternal mass is higher. If we now look at the effect of the infant sex, we showed that the interbirth interval was strongly associated with infant growth to postpartum amenorrhea, maternal rank, and also infant sex. We showed that the slower infant growth until the end of postpartum amenorrhea was associated with a longer IBI. IBI is interbirth interval. And we also found that male infants, here in purple on this graph, had a faster growth rate for a similar IBI, and that mothers of sons of all ranks also had longer IBI than did mothers of daughters. We also reported that the low-ranking mothers of sons overall had the longest investment period. Then, with this result, sons seem to cost more in terms of total time invested and in terms of growth rate during a reproductive event. However, the question of how mother will partition the investment between sons and daughters remain open. If we now shift from time cost to energy cost, we can wonder how much does an infant cost in terms of energy. So there are direct costs, like, for example, the cost of caring, the cost of lactation, and the cost of protection, which is quite difficult to measure. And there are also indirect costs, like the costs that are even more complicated to assess, like the cost of teaching, the cost of social maintenance, and the cost of learning. Here in this figure, you have the total energy intake of baboon mothers, depending on the infant age. And we did detailed measurement of energy intakes during early to peak lactation, and which showed that female baboons increase their energy intake by 30 to 50%. So these findings were quite similar to those reported in other studies that estimated maternal mean intakes, for example in orangutans, at only 20 to 25% higher than for a female with no dependent offspring. In human, for example, human lactation requires an increase in food intake of only 15 to 30%, varying among individuals and population, partly due to differences in activity levels or the chronic nutritional status. So all these results show that these increases are quite modest compared to other mammals, which can increase their intake by 2 to 4 times during the period of maximum lactation. We can also wonder how much more than expected does lactation cost a female captive baboon. So to answer this question, we use an isotopic method, the doubly labeled water, which allows to measure the total energy expenditure of the individuals. We did the measurement at 2 periods, first at the end of the first month postpartum in early lactation, and then after resumption of cycling during the second menstrual cycle. What we've shown is that we know that during early lactation, the infants are exclusively breastfed, and they are also carried by the mother most of the time. And in this case, in early lactation, the total energy expenditure is equal to 1.3 times the non-pregnant and non-lactating energy expenditure. When we did this measurement after the resumption of cycling, so infants can travel independently, but they are still suckling, and they may be also carried dorsally, so which injure a cost for the mother. And at the resumption of cycling, the energy expenditure was only 1.1 times the non-pregnant and non-lactating TEE, energy expenditure. So it's not as much as we expected, finally. Now it's a graph showing the link between energy availability and reproductive state, and so by social rank. And we showed that this energy availability, which is the difference between the intake and the expenditure, it varies by dominance rank during early lactation, with dominant females here in black having greater energy availability than subordinates in blue. And as a consequence of their lower energy availability, these low-ranking females experience a longer duration of postpartum amenorrhea. These results concur with previous studies in humans and other non-human primates, showing that postpartum amenorrhea appears to be determined by the availability of metabolic energy to support the allocation of effort to a new pregnancy. So still to look at the energetic cost of reproduction in primates, we recently conducted a study on a species of lemurs, the sifakas, living in the south of Madagascar in Berente Reserve. The highly seasonal environment of Madagascar has favored the evolution of diverse strategies for acquiring or conserving energy in an unusually stressful environment. And in lemurs, reproduction has been suggested to be even more costly for females than in other primates because of this highly seasonal climate of Madagascar. So they are therefore a very good model to understand the links between energetics and reproduction. So in this study, we focused on wild sifaka, who are seasonal breeders, and we followed 9 females coming from 9 social groups. And at the beginning of the mating season, we took some morphometric measurement, and we also used the doubly labeled water to assess their body composition and their total energy expenditure. And what we showed, and you can see on this figure, is that the females who conceived during this season were in better body condition, which means they had a higher quetlet index. The quetlet index is the body mass divided by the length, square length. So they were in better body condition than females who did not conceive. And there was also a slight trend for an effect of the tight tendon length and the abdominal skin fold. If we now look at the effect of the impact of energy expenditure on the delay to conception, what we showed is that females with higher energy expenditure at the beginning of the mating season took longer to conceive than females with low energy expenditure. If we now look at the relationship between the body condition and the chances of giving birth during the following birth season, what we found is that females who gave birth were in better body condition at the beginning of the mating seasons. So these results in a seasonal species are really in accordance with our previous results in a non-seasonal species of baboons, showing that managing energy balance is really fundamental to fertility regulation. So if we now try to summarize a bit our results, what we found is that, as in humans, energy availability in non-seasonal, non-human primates can be modeled as a non-linear relationship interacting with social status, infant growth, lactation stage, and fertility. Here in this figure, you have the energy balance on the y-axis, so positive on the upper part and negative on the lower part. And we speculate that there is a drop in the energy balance during the period of early to peak lactation, and therefore there is an increase in the energy balance and body condition associated with resumption of cycling. But the temporal sequence will vary between individuals as a function of different variables such as the mass, the social status, infant growth, and infant sex. So in this case, you see 4 lines, 1, 2, 3, 4, and these 4 lines suggest different modes of response. From, for example, the line 1 could be a large dominant female who is able to conserve energy and has therefore a very rapid return to cycling. The second line could be an average female who either increase intake or reduce activity to enhance energy balance and have regular return to cycling, let's say. The third line could be a low-ranking or older female that need a very long time to move from a negative to a positive energy balance and have, therefore, a late resumption of cycling. And the fourth line could be a female who is physiologically or ecologically, challenge and then in big difficulties to endure the cost of lactation and to resume cycling. So whether there is a threshold duration for maintaining this positive energy balance prior to resumption of cycling in large primates remains to be empirically determined. But again, managing the energy balance appears to be fundamental to the regulation of primate fertility. So to conclude, we can say that there are flexible behavioral strategies with subtle adjustments in intake and changes in time budget. Female could reduce their activity levels only slightly in order to balance energy intake against expenditure, which means they could increase their feeding time, for example, and decrease their social activities. Female condition could also influence whether a female conceives and gives birth, suggesting that females with a higher energy status were those, who had a higher energy availability for reproduction and can therefore afford to reproduce more efficiently. That's the last one. So managing energy balance seems fundamental to fertility regulation and strategies for energy acquisition, storage, or minimization of energy expenditure play a crucial role in determining long-term reproductive success. We also shown that the duration of maternal investment is adjusted to offspring growth and also to social and physical characteristics of the mother. And to conclude, last one, the social context in primates, including humans, is very important. And maximizing the social status and also the embeddedness in social networks is very important to share the costs related to the infant needs. So to conclude, I would like just to thank my collaborators, students, field assistant, and two of my colleagues that are here today with whom I conducted some study. Thanks for your attention.